I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. President Trump appears poised to appoint a new UN ambassador and a new attorney general amid renewed reports that Chief of Staff John Kelly's departure is imminent. A memorandum filed Tuesday by the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn will be followed up today with filings about Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort. Washington Post National Security Correspondent Devlin Barrett and NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro join me for a look behind the headlines. And singer-songwriter Sonia Disappear Fear sings a few tunes from her new album live in Studio A. Sunset in Baltimore today happens at 4:43, earlier than any other day this year. This hour, we'll shed as much light as possible. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. At this hour, former FBI Director James Comey is testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. And later today, the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller is expected to file a memorandum about President Trump's former campaign chair, Paul Manafort. Federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, working in conjunction with the special counsel, will also file a memorandum in a New York court today about President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. The filing about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn on Tuesday has led to a flurry of speculation and tea leaf reading about when the Mueller investigation will conclude and what it might ultimately reveal. The president has revealed his pick for two key administration positions. Devlin Barrett reports early this morning in the Washington Post that Mr. Trump will ask former Attorney General William Barr, who served in the George H.W. Bush administration, to come out of semi-retirement and take the reins again at the Justice Department. About 45 minutes ago, the president tweeted his selection of Barr, as well as his intention to nominate State Department spokeswoman and former host of Fox and Friends, Heather Nauert, to replace Nikki Haley as the ambassador to the U.N. The Labor Department released the monthly job numbers this morning. The economy added about 155,000 jobs in November. Economists were expecting to hear that about 190,000 jobs were added last month. The stock market has had a wild ride of late, dipping nearly 800 points early in the week and shaking again yesterday on the news that an executive for a large Chinese tech company had been arrested in Canada at the request of U.S. government officials. In North Carolina, Dan McCready, the Democrat in the race for the 9th District congressional seat, has rescinded his concession to Republican Mark Harris amid allegations of fraudulent handling of absentee ballots by a Republican operative hired by the Harris campaign. And the Senate is considering action against Saudi Arabia after the director of the CIA briefed senators on the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. A little later in the program, we'll check in with NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. But first, we begin with Devlin Barrett. He's a national security correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Well, welcome to the program, Devlin. Appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You've had a really busy day already. You've already filed one story, and I'm sure it may not be your last today. Let's talk about that story that you did file around 10 o'clock this morning concerning the appointment or the intention of the president to nominate William Barr as the next attorney general. What can you tell us about Bill Barr?
So Bill Barr served as the attorney general for George H.W. Bush between 1991 and 1993. He's a well-respected Republican lawyer in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I think for a lot of conservatives and even some Democrats, they're a little relieved that the president has gone with what you might call a traditional pick. Not a pick that's based on a personal relationship with the president or, you know, sort of a TV presence, which is how sometimes the president decides he likes people for certain jobs. This is a choice that comes really from, you know, sort of the established legal bar of Washington, D.C. And a Republican legal bar of Washington, D.C.
The fact that he has, chosen a so-called establishment Republican, does this indicate a change of course? Because there was a lot of speculation over the last several months, ever since Mr. Sessions was asked to resign, Jeff Sessions, the former attorney general, that, you know, Mr. Trump was really interested in getting somebody in that position who would thwart or stop completely the Mueller investigation.
Right, and the president has said as much in his tweets over recent months and years, frankly. So there was definitely an expectation that that could be the outcome here, and you know, in some quarters of the Justice Department and even in the White House, that was a concern. But I think what's interesting about this pick is that it suggests that the president wants to make a pick that's not going to necessarily prompt a big fight on in the Senate for confirmation, because that's going to be hard enough as it is given the Russian probe. And it seems as if he's sort of willing to, as he often does, frankly, with judicial picks, go the traditional route.
You write that Mr. Barr has in the past questioned the political tilt of the Mueller team. What can we assume or read between the lines of the statements that Mr. Barr has made, the editorials that he has written about the Mueller investigation and about politics in general?
So I think it's interesting. The most pointed criticism I've seen from Mr. Barr about the Mueller probe is that he thinks it was a bit of a misjudgment for Mueller to hire a bunch of lawyers who essentially, of the lawyers he hired, if they made political donations, they made them to Democrats. And obviously Mueller himself is a Republican and nominated in Republican administrations for big jobs like running the FBI. But it's interesting that Barr has expressed an opinion that he thought that was a bad idea to have a staff that seemed that on the for outward appearances, seemed only to lean Democrat. You know, I've spoken to a lot of lawyers about this issue, a lot of current and former prosecutors, and what they say is, you know, that doesn't really tell you anything, in part because the legal bar is frankly, leans Democratic anyway. But there is an appearance question there, and I think it's a valid point. Some of the other things that Barr has pointed out or made, let's say, oblique criticisms of the Mueller investigation, I think if you look at his actual wording, it turns out to be very caveated and very cautious. So I don't think we should assume out of the gate that Barr comes to the job with a pre-existing grudge against Mueller or his work. For one thing, he and Mueller worked together for a long time when they were in the Department of Justice before.
Yeah, so they know each other quite well, one would assume.
Very well, yes.
One of the things that Mr. Barr has come down, one of the issues in which he's come down on the side of the president, is he says that the president was right to fire Jim Comey as the director of the FBI. What do you make of that?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind the context in which at which point in time Barr said that. Barr wrote that in an op-ed in our newspaper, you know, just a few days after Comey was fired. And there is certainly a large group of not just Democratic ex-Justice Department officials, but Republican ex-Justice Department officials who had a real problem with how Jim Comey made some of the decisions he made. And I think the natural question for Barr at a confirmation hearing would be, does your opinion change from what you wrote then based on what has come out since you wrote it about Trump's private conversations with Comey? You know, the whole question of obstruction of justice was really not that well understood on the day he wrote that. So I think all these are valid questions, but I think he may have some simple and straightforward answers to them that may, frankly, mollify the concerns of at least some Democrats.
And we should remind listeners that Mr. Comey is at this hour appearing before a closed session of the House Judiciary Committee. He negotiated an appearance that was in closed session, but he was promised a full transcript of their conversation that will be released within the next day or so. Devlin Barrett, do you think that, for example, Jeff Flake, the outgoing senator from Arizona, who's holding up a bunch of judicial appointments, saying that he feels very strongly that there should be a bill, a resolution protecting Bob Mueller and his investigation, do you think the appointment of Bill Barr as attorney general takes the wind out of those sails?
I don't know that it takes the wind out of those sails. My guess is, I haven't spoken to Flake directly about this pick, but my guess is that this is a pick that Flake will probably be comfortable with and happy about. But it doesn't get to the core issue, which Flake is concerned about, which is, can we protect Mueller from being interfered with or fired? I do think one of the things that folks haven't really considered as they hear about this pick is that when Barr finally comes into the Justice Department, it may be that the bulk of Mueller's work has been completed. Barr may be, you know, essentially coming in as a cleanup person rather than, you know, taking over control of the thing in the heat of the work. Because even though you announce it now, the way the schedule on the Senate works is, you know, there are a number of folks in the Justice Department who don't think Barr will get a confirmation vote until February or maybe even March. So a lot can still happen in the Mueller probe before Barr shows up for that job.
Yeah, that's a really good point. One of the people, if he is appointed, who will work for him will be his own daughter, Mary Daly. Your colleague Colby Itkowitz in the Post yesterday pointed out that Mary Daly, who's the point person for the administration on the opioid crisis, is Mr. Barr's daughter, and she's currently with the Justice Department. So
that's right. She works in the Deputy Attorney General's office, so if he's confirmed, she would not report directly to her father, but obviously her father would be her ultimate boss. She handles the department's response to the opioid crisis and opioid enforcement. And she is a veteran prosecutor. She has been a prosecutor for, I believe, about 13 years. So that would certainly be an unusual dynamic, but frankly not unheard of in the Justice Department for a father and child to both, or mother and child for that matter, to both be working in the department.
Yeah, well, a father and daughter are certainly working together in the White House, so there's ample precedent for that.
Correct.
So let's talk about this story that you and your colleagues from the Post broke on Tuesday, this memorandum that the special counsel submitted having to do with the sentencing for Michael Flynn. A lot of it's redacted. People have made a lot of hay about that. There are people, engaging in all sorts of speculation, and I don't want to ask you to speculate. But I mean, as you've now, settled in with this thing, it's been a few days. I have it in front of me. They are basically recommending that the sentence given to Mr. Flynn be on the low end, if not non-existent, the low end of the schedule of the sentencing guidelines here, because they've been pretty happy with Mr. Flynn's cooperation. So now that you've lived with this for a few days, what do you make of it, and what does it tell you about what we might hear later today when we see similar filings having to do with Manafort and Cohen?
So a couple things to me stand out about the filing. One is that Mueller seems to say that a great deal of Flynn's value to the investigation was simply by cooperating and talking to them. Flynn's actions encouraged other people who worked in the White House and around Trump to be honest and forthcoming with their investigation. So it's sort of an interesting argument, because he seems to be saying that, you know, Flynn may not be a witness at a court hearing ever, and I think, frankly, the way Mueller has handled this suggests that, in fact, Flynn probably won't ever be a witness at a trial, because once he is sentenced, basically the prosecutors lose their leverage over that person. That's true in any criminal investigation, but certainly in this one. So it suggests to me that Mueller does not envision a universe in which Flynn ends up testifying publicly against anyone else in a criminal matter. But it also suggests that Flynn's cooperation was very important to them at one point, because it made other people in the White House talk to them and talk honestly with them.
And they also mentioned
that has value.
Yeah, they mentioned in this memorandum that he spoke to them early. I mean, he was one of the first people to do this. This is back at the end of last year. It's about a year ago. He had 19 interviews with the special counsel's office. They mention and go into some detail about the untruths that he said to the FBI concerning his meetings with Sergei Kislyak from Russia, as well as his dealings with the Turkish government. But he says that the investigations in which he has provided assistance are ongoing. So
exactly.
This ain't over yet.
Right, and that's a big point, because what Mueller is really saying is they have more work to do, and there will be more to say on these points later, but we are not ready to say them now because it is still a live and ongoing investigation. And that's important, too. That tells you something, too.
And part of that memorandum, as I mentioned, has a lot of the stuff redacted, but one of the words that's not redacted in the middle of a whole bunch of other stuff that is redacted, one of the terms, is criminal investigation. And that has set off a firestorm of speculation about what that might mean. Is there any further information about the criminal investigations that are alluded to in this memorandum on Tuesday?
Well, it's interesting. We already know that there are a significant number of criminal investigations that, if not directly involve the president, are, let's say, president adjacent. And so we know there is a campaign finance law investigation going on. That's obviously a criminal investigation, and that involves Michael Cohen. One of the other interesting bits in that filing, by the way, on Flynn, is that it points out that Flynn was helpful because Flynn was on the campaign in the early days. And that, to me, suggests that, you know, Flynn may even be able to give them some insight into campaign finance questions or other things that aren't immediately a function of, for example, national security relationships or foreign affairs like the Russia matter. I don't think Mueller says that in the filing by accident. So we know about the campaign finance investigation. We know that some of those actors, including Flynn, became involved at least a little bit with an ongoing corruption probe involving Turkish officials. So it's possible that's part of this as well. And then, look, we also know that at the root of this thing is an investigation into whether there was some sort of conspiracy between anyone in the Trump campaign and the Kremlin, and if there was any effort to obstruct justice once folks around the president realized there was an investigation of that behavior. And obviously Flynn is important to both those.
There is, of course, breathless anticipation about the two memoranda that will appear later today. The court has ordered these memoranda to be submitted. Today's the deadline. And they come about two very different kinds of witnesses. One is Paul Manafort, whom the special counsel has said breached his plea agreement. And you wrote about this last week. The other is Michael Cohen, the president's former personal lawyer, who appears to be considerably more cooperative. What's your hunch about what we can expect, and is there a sort of knowable next move after these two sentencing memoranda are submitted?
So I have a sneaking suspicion that the two filings today will be interesting. Well, actually, technically three filings, because we're going to get two Cohen filings and then a Manafort filing. I suspect that these filings will be similar to the filing we saw Tuesday involving Flynn, and that they will tell us a little bit more, but I doubt they're going to reveal a ton more, because I haven't seen much that would have changed Mueller's calculation between Tuesday and today. That's just an educated guess on my part, but I do think that the broader landscape of this investigation hasn't changed a ton from Tuesday, when Mueller said he still needed to keep a lot of stuff secret. So I expect we'll see something like that. I am very curious to see how revealing the discussion of Manafort's alleged lies are, because that could give an interesting indication of what issues Mueller is still pursuing aggressively, even now, you know, more than a year and a half after he began his part of this investigation.
We got to let you go, I know, but I do want to ask you to speculate perhaps about one other thing. This morning I was at the gym. I was on the stationary bike about 5:45, and I had my phone. I was reading the Washington Post, among other things, and the president was tweeting up a storm. I mean, he was just going nuts very early in the morning. It indicates that the president, I mean, he said, for example, one of his tweets was, "We will be doing a major counter report to the Mueller report. This should never again be allowed to happen to a future president." He seems to think that a report from the special counsel is imminent. Do you think that as well?
It depends on what you mean by imminent. I've covered a lot of officials who like to use the word soon, and it was amazing. Some officials view the word soon as 3 days, and some view the word soon as 3 months. I think we are entering the home stretch towards a report, but I think that could still come, you know, well after the holidays, let's say. But I do think that we are getting closer and closer to that. And you know, from my reporting, there seems to be both a draft report and the Trump folks have been saying they have a draft rebuttal report. So I do think we're getting close. But obviously, if you look at the filings so far this week, Mueller is basically saying to the world, I'm not quite there yet.
Yeah, the president even said that they've got 87 pages so far, you know, of the rebuttal report. Devin Barrett covers national security and law enforcement for The Washington Post. He does so with tremendous skill and erudition. Devin, thank you so much for your time today. I know it's a busy one for you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Domenico Montanaro of NPR joins me for more of the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, we begin a series called Midday on Higher Education. Over the next several months, we'll talk with the presidents of colleges and universities throughout Maryland and talk about the challenges each of their institutions face and how those institutions are connected to the fabric of the communities in which they are located. Our first guest in this series is Dr. Maria Thompson. She is the president of Coppin State University here in Baltimore, and she will join me for the hour on Midday Monday. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Joining us now on the line from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., Domenico Montanaro. He's the lead editor for politics and digital audience at NPR and one of the hosts of the NPR Politics podcast. If you haven't checked it out already, I can only imagine how embarrassed you are. Domenico, it's good to talk to you. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks. Let's start with Heather Nauert. She is, according to a tweet from the president this morning, about to be nominated as UN ambassador. She's been at the State Department, both with Secretary Tillerson as well as the current Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. What do you know about her? What do you think about this pick, and how do you think it's going to play in Congress?
Well, you know, she is a former Fox News host and had become the spokesperson at the State Department. So it raised some eyebrows, given she lacks any diplomatic experience, really. But this president is somebody who has said that he takes his advice from people he sees on the shows, and I guess he means it.
Yeah.
And that's what we see. The fact is, she's articulate. He's someone who obviously believes that she can do this job, that she will articulate his vision for what the country can be at the United Nations. And I suppose that's exactly what a president would want, is somebody who can articulate what his vision is to the rest of the world. It's going to be a bit of a learning curve, though.
Yeah, she doesn't have any particular foreign policy experience other than having worked at the State Department now for the last couple of years. She didn't get along very well, by most reports, with Secretary Tillerson. She gets along a lot better with Mr. Pompeo. What will the Senate make of that, for example?
Well, she'll face a lot of tough questioning, I would assume, especially on policy, whether or not she gets some of the nuance of various countries and what's going on in the world. I would assume if this Khashoggi killing continues to be something that is splitting Republicans on Capitol Hill with President Trump, that she's going to have to figure out a way to answer that question before any kind of Senate appointment or Senate hearing. So, you know, there's still a lot to go for her. Most likely the Senate and Senate Republicans who control this process will likely give her the benefit of the doubt, but there's going to be a lot that she's going to need to prove to them.
And speaking of Jamal Khashoggi, there was an extraordinary briefing to the Senate from the head of the CIA about the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman's culpability in the death of this journalist for The Washington Post. What came out of that briefing? And it seems that there are a number of senators, including many Republicans, willing to peel away from the administration on this particular issue.
Yeah, what came out of that briefing were a lot of angry Republicans, frankly, who felt like they were being whitewashed a little bit when it came to the earlier briefings by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who, by the way, ironically, was the former head of the CIA, who was essentially downplaying the CIA's report, fingering Mohammed bin Salman as at least having known about the killing, if not having a hand in directing it. So, you know, this became a big thing where you saw people like Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, Bob Corker, the outgoing senator from Tennessee, even other senators like Richard Shelby from Alabama, who, you know, said that they were disappointed with what the administration had said or done so far, and expressed, frankly, a level of outrage that you haven't seen on a lot of issues between Republicans and the president.
Lindsey Graham from South Carolina was asked whether there was a smoking gun, and he said there was a smoking saw.
Yeah.
You know, a gruesome reference to how evidently the body of Mr. Khashoggi was disposed of. It's also come to light that Saudi Arabia paid for some 500 hotel rooms at the Trump Hotel in Washington. These are for veterans who were in town for various events. Has anybody been mentioning that in relation to possible Senate action?
Well, certainly it's been part of the conversation in Washington as far as, you know, things like the Emoluments Clause go and whether or not a president can take foreign gifts. You know, whether or not any of that's going to have any salience, however, with Republicans is a different story. Nothing has so far, and there's been plenty that could have been investigated. And that is one of the key important factors in Democrats taking back the House, because you can guarantee that a slew of investigations surrounding the president's finances and the ethical lapses even within this administration are going to start to come under scrutiny, which is the purview of the House and their investigative authority.
What do you expect the Senate will do? Will there be a resolution, a law, a recommendation? What's your take on what's likely to happen?
You know, it's unclear at this point with Khashoggi and what they're going to try to do. There have been some discussion about the Yemen resolution. There was a resolution that some Republican senators, bipartisan actually, group of senators put out, you know, essentially without much teeth, saying that it was a problem, that what had happened is something that the U.S., you know, doesn't think is a good thing. So, you know, whether or not there's going to be anything with any teeth, though, is difficult to see, because it could politically put the president in a little bit of a difficult box if they decide to try to sanction Saudi Arabia or Saudi Arabian officials, which are possibilities at this point.
Domenico Montanaro is my guest. He's the political editor for NPR. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap. So, Domenico, on the NPR Politics podcast a couple of days ago, you did a report about the National Republican Congressional Committee saying that it was hacked during the midterms this last election, earlier last month. Anything that compares to what happened to the DNC in the 2016 election?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that stood out to me about that was that Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida who ran for president, really tried to pump the brakes on a lot of Republicans who felt like they wanted to boast gleefully about the Democratic National Committee being hacked. You had President Trump himself go and say publicly that Russia should go try to find the emails of Hillary Clinton. You know, you had his now campaign manager, then digital director, you know, sort of jibing the Democratic National Committee, saying, oh, don't they know about, you know, two-factor authentication? You know, it's stuff like that. And Rubio was saying, look, you know, this could happen to anybody. As soon as Russia or China or whoever decides that whatever's happening within the United States is not what they like, or they just want to sow dissent, they could try to go after any of them. And they did so this time. We don't know exactly who is responsible for this. People at the NRCC have been quoted as saying that they believe it could be a foreign actor. We have a lot of questions still on whether that's the case or not. They base that on some of the level of sophistication of the hack. And there are still a lot of details that aren't known at this point. But there are potential emails and back and forth between members of Congress and the National Republican Congressional Committee in a year when Republicans didn't do so well in the House and could see that happening. You wonder what kinds of things were said back and forth. And I'm sure that's part of the reason why the NRCC kept this quiet for so long, because they didn't want to alarm anybody on Capitol Hill who could have their information, their sensitive information, compromised.
You also reported about this extraordinary election in North Carolina's 9th congressional district. The Democrat, a guy named McCready, had conceded that election to his Republican opponent. And now Democrats are alleging some pretty serious voter fraud. And Democrats aren't alone. There are several Republicans who are also suspicious that some fraudulent activity took place. In particular, Representative Robert Pittenger, who lost in the primary to Mark Harris, he suspects that there were some problems even in the primary concerning absentee ballots in particular. What's going on down there in North Carolina?
Yeah, it's a very odd situation. And, Mark Harris had led by some 905 votes over McCready. McCready has since pulled back his concession. And, the Board of Elections down there said that they saw some funny activity. It most notably was around collection of absentee ballots. So you're not supposed to give your ballot or have somebody try to collect your ballot who's a third party person. You know, it's only you or a near relative in North Carolina who can fill out a ballot and send it in. Well, what is being alleged is that individuals were going around door knocking in predominantly black, predominantly Democratic areas and saying, here's an absentee ballot, fill it out, I'll hand it in for you. And, people report that their ballots were either never turned in, or you could circle a second person on there and then the ballot would be nullified. So no one knows exactly what happened, but there are some numbers that came out of that county, Bladen County in particular, that are alarming. I mean, you think about, this is an area that's heavily Democratic and yet went heavily for the Republican Harris. Something doesn't quite add up is what a lot of people are looking at. And, whether or not there are enough votes or enough absentee ballots that could change the margin, that might not even matter. There may very well have been, by the way, but that may not even matter. They may wind up having to do a do-over in this election, one of the things people are talking about, because of illegal activity.
And that really is extraordinary. I mean, do-over elections
Absolutely.
Are really rare. And
really rare.
In just the last 24 hours, the head of the Republican Party in North Carolina seemed to be somewhat open to that idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is remarkable. And I think to a broader point here, the president of the United States likes to talk about voter fraud. He was tweeting up a storm about voter fraud post-election when we were looking at the recounts in Florida, the potential for a recount in Georgia, looking at the race in Arizona, some of the House races that were decided later in California. But you don't see the president on Twitter talking about this race. You don't see the president talking about this kind of information. And, normally in a normal time, and certainly with President Trump, a lot of the norms have been thrown out the window. Presidents want to be on the side of voter access and keeping elections free and fair so that the entire country has faith in the system, and some of that's been eroded in the past 2 years.
Let me ask you about the filings that we are expecting. We were talking about these earlier with Devlin Barrett of the Washington Post, but you've got these two very different witnesses, Paul Manafort, the former campaign chair, and Michael Cohen, the former personal lawyer for Mr. Trump, with very different dispositions and very different levels of cooperation with the special counsel. The fact that the Manafort agreement with the Mueller team has apparently dissolved, is that a big loss for the special counsel as he pursues his investigation? I mean, the fact that he doesn't appear to have the cooperation of Mr. Manafort, regardless of the fact that he certainly appears to have the cooperation of Mr. Cohen, the cooperation of Michael Flynn and others. What do you make of Manafort's behavior over the last few months?
It's hard to say because we just get sort of drips and drabs of the picture that Mueller lets us kind of know about when he brings out these filings. And we'll get a little bit more today when we find out what his some more of the detail on the Manafort case and how he, you know, why their plea deal kind of fell through. And, you know, sure, could it be a potential problem for Mueller because maybe Manafort could have had some information to help? Maybe. Or it could be another situation where it winds up hurting the president and people close to him even more so because he apparently lied, Manafort, to Mueller. And if he was doing that while at the same time trying to get his story straight with Rudy Giuliani and some of the president's attorneys, and if any of that message got back to the president and anything that the president had submitted to Mueller and some of those questions wind up being false in the way that he was trying to keep his story straight with Manafort, well, that's a problem, a big problem for the president. We don't know if any of that is true. That's some of the speculation. And, you know, we're going to find out in drips and drabs, like I said, from the Mueller team as he decides to release that information.
Domenico Montanaro directs the political coverage at NPR. We've got a link to the NPR Politics podcast on our website, wypr.org/midday. If you haven't yet taken a listen, it is well worth your time. Domenico, always a pleasure, sir. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad you you listened. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Before we take a quick break, I'd like to thank Bottoms Up Bagels as well. They've served lunch for us today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating way back to the 1940s. Bottoms Up Bagels offers a customized catering package of all kinds, and they're available at the Waverly and JFX farmers markets as well as online at bottomsupbagels.com. We want to thank also Healthy People Juice. They provided fresh, local, artisan cold-press vegetable and fruit juices for us today. Healthy People Juice is a social enterprise centered around community service and health. They offer a variety of cold-pressed organic juices. They're located in Fells Point. You can find out more at healthypeoplejuice.com. Coming up, the singer-songwriter Sonia Disappear Fear joins me right here in Studio A. She's got a new CD called By My Silence. She's going to play a couple of tunes from the album when we come back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.